Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. Confession. This week has turned me into, at least temporarily, a TGIF person, which I never thought I would be. Who am I? My name is Ben.
Which TGIF person are you, Ben? Are you Steve Urkel, or are you more of a Carl, or maybe the Olsen twins, or a Balky? You're sort of a Balky-esque figure.
That's very kind of you.
I know you like Perfect Strangers, is all I'm saying.
Yeah. Noel, you're Noel. I appreciate that immensely. I love that theme song. That is one of my favorite theme songs of all sitcom time. It's a banger, right?
It's inspirational, downright inspirational, if you ask me. We're standing tall on the wings of our dreams. Mm-hmm. What does that even mean, though? It's a little confusing. How can you stand on wings? And do dreams have? I mean, it's a little, the imagery flummoxes me a bit, but I do find the melody, the soaring melody, really gets me riled up in a good way.
Yeah.
Not a sexual way, though.
Oh, that's good to know. But, you know, it's 2020. Live your truth, bro. Speaking of fantastic segues, of course, where would we be without our super producer, Casey Pegram? Casey, are you a Perfect Strangers fan, just sitcom wise, like theme song wise, maybe?
Oh yeah, it's I think it's objectively one of the better theme songs from that decade, and that decade is rife with great themes. So, quite an achievement to be one of the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
Not to get too in the weeds about sitcom themes, but the songcraft of them was always really impressed me, because you got to pack like everything a 3.5 minute song would have into like 45 seconds. There's even a bridge in the Perfect Strangers theme. Okay, I mean, that's the last I'm going to say on that topic, but really impressive songwriting.
There's like some real time distortion happening in those themes when it feels like, you know, minutes have passed, but you've really only been there for 30, 45 seconds. It's impressive.
Mm-hmm. It's such a download of exposition. And the weird thing is you can hear the full versions, you know, online easily now. They don't hold up. They're not as catchy as the sitcom ones. I love the exposition. We should do, I propose we do an episode on sitcom themes in the future, because, you know, I read somewhere that there's like a relatively small cadre of people who are responsible for most of the real bangers. You know, as a kid, and I don't know why, I was myopically fascinated with the Mr. Belvedere theme song. And it's one of those that's doing what we're talking about, where it just like explains the whole crazy situation. Also the nanny, Fran Drescher, if you're hearing this, I'm on Twitter. So, what do you think, Noel? Would that be an interesting idea for a future episode?
Absolutely. And Fran, get at me too. I'm on Instagram. How now, Noel Brown? I always had a big old nanny crush, even though it didn't age well with me personally. Mm-hmm. But when I was of a certain age, that Fran Drescher really got my dander up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fran Drescher. I had feelings I didn't understand at the time. but let's move on to today's episode. This is something that may also be a little bit difficult for many of us listening in the modern day to understand, and that is this. Back in the day, just like now, people were trying to do everything they could to ensure that they lived as long as possible and that they were healthy and virile and vital while they were alive. You can see it today in things like anti-aging creams of dubious efficacy. And today's episode is about something even more dubious. People thought that they could improve their physical health by doing something incredibly strange. Noel, you want to do the honors on this one?
Well, yes, Ben. And I think we can explain the topic of today's episode with a quote from Exodus 32:19, in which Moses ascended the mountain to meet with the Lord. And after receiving the Ten Commandments from his Lord, Moses came down from on high upon the mountain, where he saw the people worshiping a
golden calf that they had made, an idol. And Moses' anger waxed hot. He took the golden calf, burned it in fire, ground it into powder, and sprinkled it upon the water. Moses made the children of Israel drink of it. The powder Moses sprinkled upon the water was gold dust.
That's my dramatic reading for the day. But yeah, drinking gold was a thing. Dates back to biblical times. Apparently, there was some kind of notion that it was imbued with magical properties. I don't know. They weren't really doing, you know, clinical studies at the time. It had to have been based on just some sort of like hunch, I guess. What do you think, Ben?
It's strange because, you know, gold has a really long history throughout human civilization as a therapeutic agent, similar in some ways to silver. First, it was used as a metal, right? And then, of course, there's the dust reference in biblical times. And then it was used as a soluble salt made by alchemists, the predecessors of chemists. You know, you'll recognize them as the dudes who set out to like make the philosopher's stone and then invented pesticides and things like that. Some of them were convinced that this substance, gold, could be, by the way, I just have to point out, it is element 79 on the periodic table.
Is it Fe? No, that's iron. Gold is Na?
Au.
Au, that's right.
Sodium is Na or nitrogen.
That's right. You got me on the periodic table stuff. No. And, you know, it sounds a lot like this Moses story. I just really wanted an excuse to read in my most biblical of voices. It was an example of like him kind of rubbing the children of Israel's noses in what they had done and, you know, treating them like bad boys and girls because they, you know, worshiped this idol. But the notion that gold was this kind of magical elixir of life that would, you know, extend your life can be traced all the way back to China in 2500 BC.
Yeah, this is where we see the first instance of someone preparing something like potable gold. Potable is just a dressed up word meaning drinkable, like potable water you probably hear in survival scenarios. And also in Egypt, drinking gold water was thought to enhance your youth. In Ayurvedic medicine today in India, red colloidal gold is still used for roughly the same thing, rejuvenation, revitalization. And it's strange because, you know, going back to alchemy, if we look at the history of this, making drinkable gold is something that alchemists were super obsessed with for an incredibly long time.
Yeah, alchemy in general. I mean, gold, making something out of nothing, like turning, you know, a non-precious metal into the most precious of metals, that was gold being chief amongst them. So gold, the alchemists were pretty gold focused. But yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, back in those ancient times when alchemists were really looked at as these, you know, great kind of pillars of the community. They were almost like medicine men or you know, like physicians, really. And they were trusted in, and they were thought to be generating something that actually could cure what ails you. It's interesting. You were talking about just a minute ago, the red colloidal gold that's used in India. Today, also, colloidal silver is sort of one of those, is it, isn't it, snake oil or not, kind of remedies that a lot of people swear by. But yeah, back to alchemy, it was common knowledge that gold was not soluble in water. So the idea of making a drinkable gold was kind of a, you know, super power move in and of itself, and demonstrated some sort of mastery of, I don't know, the dark arts, the light arts, I guess. An alchemist was more, I guess, into, you know, magic for good, I guess, right?
You know, they labored under some stereotypes, you know what I mean? Especially if they were the only people in the region who could read. Just like a lot of medical practitioners at the time, you know, an alchemist was in higher than average danger of being accused of witchcraft. In the 8th century AD, there's this Arabian alchemist. His name is Jabir ibn Hayyan, or you'll hear him called Kerber sometimes. He made the biggest breakthrough in drinkable gold when he invented something called aqua regia. He combined hydrochloric and nitric acid. he created one of the few substances that can dissolve gold. So this is useful for a lot of things, right? If we're being practical and a little bit mundane about it, you can use this substance to help you with gold extraction. You can use it to purify gold, but they wanted to use it for other things. They wanted to use it for its perceived curative qualities. And since the 8th century AD in this part of the world, alchemists spent 1,000 years, maybe more, trying to figure out where else they could go with this. European alchemists found this secret written in a couple of books in the 9th and 10th centuries. And we know from other records, some famous medieval alchemists had claimed that they had discovered an actual life elixir. And that's the thing we see a lot with alchemy. You'll see somebody who says like Michael Scott, not from The Office, but The Alchemist, they'll say that they've made something, right? Some big secret, but they won't straight out tell you what it is or how they got it.
Well, then help me with this, Ben. You know, I a minute ago was sort of joking about using magic for good or whatever. And, you know, alchemy was not, they would not have considered themselves to be manipulating any kind of supernatural forces. They were, you know, supposedly using a precursor to chemistry and, you know, using science. But a lot of this stuff about transmutation and turning things into other things, there's some magical thinking that goes along with that. And a lot of it was bunk, right? I mean, just to clarify the whole kind of trajectory of alchemy in general.
Yeah. And we have to keep in mind that in these times, science and spirituality were not considered naturally in opposition. You know what I mean? You would have Christian alchemists who were using what we would call something like science to prove their spiritual beliefs, right? So there's some confirmation bias in there. It's a very interesting evolution. If we fast forward to the 13th century, we know those alchemists like Michael Scott. I don't know why it's so funny to me. It's Michael Scott with one T, for the record. Roger Bacon and a couple of others had already written about this drinkable gold, which they called aurum potabile. And because of all the different people who are working on this over the centuries, this drinkable gold got a reputation, kind of a snake oil reputation, like something you'd see at a medicine show. It was called a panacea, that it could cure all diseases, that like, hey, if you had any affliction, you know, whether you've got like brain ghosts or you've got toe fever, then just drink gold.
Those pesky brain ghosts, man. I can't get rid of them. They follow me wherever I go, whispering sweet nothings to me. So then there was this guy who, I just love this name. His name is Paracelsus. That in and of itself sounds like some sort of like stomach medicine. So he seems legit just by his name alone. He really was a big force in kind of really spreading this notion of potable gold as this elixir of life that could cure anything that ailed you, you know, and also, you know, keep your skin fresh and rejuvenated looking. Probably do wonderful things for your hair as well, I imagine. But yeah, it was used to treat fevers and all kinds of ailments and, you know, indigestion and anything that you could think of. But it actually caused more problems than it cured. There was this condition known as auric fever that, surprise, surprise, you expose yourself to metal over a long period of time, you start to get this thing that causes you to sweat profusely. And the way it's described in this article from BMJ.com is to have a very abundant flow of urine, in addition to irritations in your gutty parts, and also could really cause, I mean, heavy metals in your, well, I mean, I guess it's not a heavy metal, but it's definitely not something that probably should be ingested in your body to that degree. And it would, you know, understandably cause damage to your kidneys trying to filter it out. And also you would, you know, drool a lot. It would mess with your production of saliva.
Mm-hmm. And after a certain threshold, you could even die. Deaths from gold intoxication were described. They were not uncommon, but still people thought, you know, that's sort of how a lot of medicine works. It can be, what can be beneficial in small doses can be dangerous in large doses. And people still praised this historically. Paracelsus, introduced earlier, said, "Of all elixirs, gold is supreme and the most important for us. Gold can keep the body indestructible. Drinkable gold will cure all illnesses. It renews and restores." And it's weird because that's kind of like this ancient TV infomercial language, right? It's like, do you have double elbow?
Exactly.
Gold.
It's like bone broth or something. Totally. Mm-hmm.
Nailed it. Yeah.
By the way, you guys, I can't let this go. Paracelsus's full name was thus. Let me see if I can even get through this. This is incredible. Philippius Aurelius Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim.
Nice.
AKA street name Paracelsus. And he was Swiss, by the way. Wow. Theophrastus Bombastus? Are you kidding me?
I know. Drop the beat. I'll freestyle to that.
Paracelsus
Bombastus. So we're setting the stage here to say that gold was used for a lot of things. And we've got numerous cases across the world of people saying gold is the cure for what ails you, regardless of what your symptoms might be. But as we've been foreshadowing, it really takes off as an anti-aging trend during the Middle Ages. This is also the time when apothecaries, aka predecessors of pharmacists, would sell things like scorpion oil and spiderweb elixirs, which I love because it kind of reminds me of Skyrim, which is just a fantastic video game. And we know that gold drinking has been a suggested practice and suggested to have medicinal application for thousands and thousands of years. And when we fast forward to the Elizabethan era, we know that the use of drinkable gold was well enough established in European culture of the time that even Shakespeare mentioned it. In Henry IV, Prince Henry blames the gold crown for his father's illness, saying, "I spake unto this crown as having sense, and thus upbraided it. The care on thee depending hath fed upon the body of my father. Therefore, thou best of gold art worst of gold. Other less fine in carat is more precious, preserving life in medicine potable."
Ben, I was shaking my fist as you were doing that reading. It really, really got to me. That was good. What?
So he's saying, like, you know, the gold crown is what's making my father ill. But, you know, the real gold, the helpful gold, is maybe less impressive in terms of carats and appearance, but it is real medicine because you can drink it.
Interesting. Okay, I see it now. I see it now, Ben. Thank you for walking me through that. That's interesting, man. Okay, so let's not the present, I guess, but I think moving on to the 16th century, when we have Henry II, whose mistress actually drank gold in order to stay youthful and you know, attractive to her, not husband. What does a mistress call her liaison, her lover?
Maybe lover, maybe liaison, I like. Maybe, I mean, in the parlance of our day, it's sugar daddy, but I want something more classy for this because we're talking about aristocrats here.
Well, how about a zaddy?
Okay. Zaddy's, you know what? Good. Let's go with it.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, she wanted to stay, you know, trim and fit for her zaddy. And there was a study that was published in the British Medical Journal that actually chronicled this. But I think she might have had a little too much. Like you said, Ben, little dabble, do you? And according to toxicology reports, this eventually led to her poisoning herself.
Yeah, you're right, Noel. Diane de Poitiers, Casey, I'm gonna check with you on the French there.
Yeah, that would be something like Diane de Poitiers.
Casey on the case, not that bad. Yes, so Diane de Poitiers is one of the few 100% confirmed cases of someone dying by drinking gold. She was, as you said, Noel, she was the infamous mistress of King Henri II of France. And she was a well-taught, well-rounded, educated person. She studied music, hunting, languages, and she was given what I would say is a pretty high-end education for a young woman in the Renaissance era.
Totally. Question, though, for everyone and for history. Why is the mistress got to be the infamous one? I mean, what about the king? Is he not to blame, you know, for cheating on his wife? Well, I don't understand why all the blame goes on the woman. That's just my hot take.
Yeah, I have a low opinion of kings in general. You guys both know this about me. I would say maybe she's infamous because of the manner of her death. I don't know.
Yeah, that could well be. It's a good point. Infamous, though, I just think of as meaning you did something dastardly. This was more just kind of a sad product of her trying to stay in the good favor of her jerky king, you know, Zaddy.
Mm-hmm. She married someone 39 years her senior when she was 15. His name was Louis de Brézé. He was the grandson of King Charles VII, and he had served in the court of King Francis I. And so this marriage had to have, I mean, maybe it was romantic, but we have to remember the idea of marrying for romantic love is sadly a relatively recent invention in history. This may have been a political move. She served as the lady-in-waiting to Queen Claude, and then her and her husband had two daughters before Louis passed away in 1531, leaving Diane 32 years old. She started wearing black and white as, you know, a symbol of mourning, and she would keep these colors for the rest of her life. So at this time, she's, as we said, 32 years old. She's already renowned for her beauty. Imagine the 16th century version of a bunch of people coming up to a pretty person and saying, "Oh my God, what's your secret? Maybe it's you. Maybe it's Maybelline." In this case, it was gold. We'll get to this. She did become the mistress of Henry II. Their affair is believed to have begun when she was 35 and when the king was 16. For a time, she was the most powerful woman in France, even more powerful than the legitimate queen. Then when Henri passed away in 1559, Diane had a pretty precipitous fall from grace. She got banished, and eventually she died at the age of 66. But here's the thing. Contemporary reports said that she looked super young. Like when she was 50, she looked 30, things like that. And everybody kind of believed that her secret was that she was drinking gold. Now, maybe that sounds like a catty rumor courtiers spread, but in this case, Noel, it turns out to be true, right?
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, she wasn't getting accused of, like, bathing in virgin's blood or anything. Right. Like they've heard that. That's, you know, because this is something that, you know, was available. This was a pretty relatively known concoction that you could get in a lot of the apothecaries in the French court, because they actually believed that gold harnessed the power of the sun. And a lot of that comes from those kind of alchemical notions of power in the substance. Wasn't that what they called it, Ben? Didn't they call gold the substance?
I like it. I might just like the way you say it, but I say we'll go with it. Can you do it one more time?
The substance.
It's kind of like you're tickling my ears. That's beautiful. Now, of course, given the time frame and given how much time has passed between our podcast and this poor woman's death, you would reasonably assume that this would remain a rumor or an anecdote. However, we have the benefit of some forensic science. You see, three scientists in 2008 actually solved the case of Diane's death, and they did it in a somewhat grisly way. I don't know. What do you think?
It was a little grisly. I mean, you know, it definitely involves some digging up of corpses, but you know, enough time had passed, they were obviously just bones. And they did just that in 2008. This group of scientists
unearthed the bones of Poitiers, and they were able to confirm that they were in fact hers, because the they matched up her jawbone to a portrait of her, and also one of her leg bones had a perfect clean break from a documented riding accident, which is pretty interesting. That's a pretty good detective work there. And then they actually had access to some of her hair from a collection of her own hair that she kept. The palatial country home where she was exiled to. Sounds terrible. The Chateau d'Annay, which was given to her by Henri, and she was allowed to live out her days there when Catherine de' Medici, who was Henri's wife, banished his mistress. And in measuring those hair samples, they were able to find that it contained gold levels 500 times above normal tolerances. Also, a lot of mercury traces in there, which apparently was another ingredient of this potion. So not knowing what we know now, Ben, pretty terrible combination there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just imagine 500 times. Shout out to everybody who's currently thinking of the etymology of mad as a hatter. You mentioned haberdashers and mercury. So the scientists team up with a guy who usually works in hospital morgues, and they conclusively identify Diane de Poitiers' body, as you said. And then they were able to measure those chemical levels in her hair. And they also noted that there is a scientific basis for the reason that people might have said that she looked unusually young, because this level of gold consumption can give you white skin from anemia. It can give you fragile hair, bones, and teeth. And this is exactly the state she was in when she passed away. We're getting some of this from an excellent article in The Telegraph. And, you know, as you said, she had been banished to that chateau before she passed away. She was 66. It was 1566. She was originally buried in a really nice chapel, but during the French Revolution, her grave was desecrated. They threw her in a commoner or pauper's grave, and that's why it took so long to find her. A pit, yes,
yeah,
a pit.
Yeah, that's wild. I gotta say, Ben, given the time, and obviously, you know, people's life expectancy was not what it is today, 66 seems a pretty ripe old age, doesn't it? I wonder how long she would have lived if she had not been, you know, slow poisoning herself over decades and decades.
That's a good question, Noel, and I believe it's one that we will have to endeavor to answer another day. But it's so crazy. Dare I say it's ridiculous. People are out here drinking gold.
I know, man. I'll tell you one thing we do know, though. That youthful complexion that it supposedly gave her, which essentially was just being like super pale, was the result of anemia. So, you know, there are better ways, there are better remedies to keep that youthful glow than to drink toxic chemicals. I think that's the takeaway from today's episode.
Yeah, and in gold's defense, it has been used pharmaceutically in the treatment of rheumatism. So we want to say it's not all complete woo or pseudoscience. But I don't know, man. You know, as you know, my aversion to metals, I can't imagine drinking gold. It's like, for me, it's like how you would imagine if you had to get in bed and your bed had 13 parrots in it every night under the covers.
Ben, I'm so triggered right now. I can't even handle it. My skin is literally crawling.
Oh, man. I wouldn't, you know, I like some birds, and I wouldn't even hop in that bed. But luckily, we have the benefits of the modern day, both in our understanding about the science and chemistry involved in drinking or ingesting gold. We also have the benefit of ornithology and knowing that parrots do not belong in beds. And as always, I feel like just to be safe, we should say this. You guys, we are not medical professionals. We haven't told anybody to drink gold, but please, please, be mindful of it. You know what? Is it a hot take if I say don't drink gold? Is that a hot take?
Oh, no. No, Ben. Don't drink gold.
don't put foreign objects in your nose, and don't dig too deep with those Q-tips, guys. Come on. I know it says you're not supposed to put them in your ears, but we all do. So at least exercise a little bit of restraint when you're jabbing around in there.
Mm-hmm.
My PSA for the day.
There we go. Yes, the more you know, because we love to hear from you and we love when you tune into the show and you need your ears to do that most times. So this is another one for the Ridiculous History Books. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Casey Pegram. Thanks, of course, to our research associate, Gabe Luzia.
Massive thanks to Christopher Hasiotis, who is here in spirit with us, as always, watching over us like a Mufasa in the sky. And then thanks to Jonathan Strickland and his dastardly alter ego, the Quister, who I believe will be joining us one of these days for a Quister Core edition. We can call him the Quarster. No?
A little hard to say. Quarinster, maybe? That extra syllable? I don't know. Yeah, we are long overdue for a Quister appearance. You know, just peek behind the curtain here, folks. The three of us were talking off air, and we kind of missed the guy, but no one tell him that.
Definitely not. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.